The story you're about to hear on Love, Lust, Fear is true. Some names, places, and other identifying details may have changed to protect the storyteller. Love, Lust, Fear may contain graphic language and depictions of sensitive situations. Please listen with caution. Next on Love, Lust, Fear.
But the end of that marriage is where I learned to equate chemicals with avoiding pain. Alcohol became a problem pretty quickly for me. I just continued to choose worse and worse partners along the way because I lost my self-respect. There was somebody that lived in a town not too far away. I liked his look. It was definitely a rock and roll look, and he had a picture on a motorcycle. I put my house up for rent, and within a month, I had moved in with him, sold most of my belongings. So within record time, I'm fired from my great job, already have given up the house that I had just reestablished. And so at this point, I'm pretty realizing that I'm dependent on him. Anything I told him, any vulnerability I shared with him, would become his weapon the next time. It would be whatever he would control me with, or, you know, something to make me feel bad about. He got a restraining order. What he did that night was call the ambulance and tell them that I was suicidal. It was more of how he could get me legally out of his house because I was no longer making money at the time.
Born into a loving Catholic family along the East Coast, Deborah was raised believing in lifelong commitment and never pursued dating. While not shy, she maintained a reserved demeanor, especially around the opposite sex. But when her marriage ended with a shocking revelation, she felt a deep sense of betrayal. It shattered her self-worth and bred insecurity. Seeking a way to regain her confidence, she turned to alcohol and walked down a dark path of pain and regret. But it was after embracing sobriety that she met a man who mirrored her toxic tendencies and once again found herself trapped in a tumultuous cycle of chaos, addiction, and abuse.
I was adopted by a family, and my mother and father had a seemingly great marriage, and they talked to each other at night. My dad would always be excited to come home. So I had a great example of a relationship. For each of them, it was the first person they had dated. So I wonder if I had some type of expectation as to, oh, a relationship's always going to work out. You just have to get through it. I really didn't have a date the whole way through high school. So as soon as I started getting involved in community theater, pretty much the first date I had, I married him. As soon as I saw him, I'm like, oh, this is great. We'll get married, and no matter what, we'll be happy. My husband, he told me he had been dressing up as a woman and that he might eventually like to go that way. We had been married at about 7 years at that point, and I really tried to make myself go with it, but I have to say it was like the feeling of betrayal, because how could somebody that was my best friend for that long keep that secret from me? And I had a problem getting over that. That, honestly, is when I really started drinking. Because up to that point, I didn't like alcohol. I thought people were obnoxious when they drank. But the end of that marriage is where I learned to equate chemicals with avoiding pain. That's what helped me be able to connect with more people. I had a problem approaching anybody for a date, or the whole thing made me uncomfortable, the whole I'm not good enough thing. So alcohol became a problem pretty quickly for me. I generally would find somebody also that drank. When I was just recklessly drinking, I would be drunk and go home with whoever, you know, was buying the next drink. I just continued to choose worse and worse partners along the way because I lost my self-respect. So my first time going to a rehab, I was able to maintain periods of sobriety for 5 years, 7 years. At that time, I either wouldn't date, or if I did date, it was somebody that was going to recovery meetings. I had just come out of alcohol treatment. I was sober and doing well. And at the time, I was working as a traveling nurse for a hospice. I had rented a 2-bedroom house for just myself and my 2 dogs at the time. I had never used a dating app before in my life, but I had a computer. So I went on Plenty of Fish. And of course, I tried to look for somebody locally because I just wanted somebody to go out with. And the first time I went on the app the next morning, I had like 70 responses. But as I would go through them, I just couldn't find anybody that I clicked with. There was somebody that lived in a town not too far away. I liked his look. It was definitely a rock and roll look. And he had a picture on a motorcycle. I just sent a, hey, hello, what's up type of thing. I may have even sent a second email. And then when he called back, it was the first voicemail I had gotten from anybody I had sent a message to. I loved his voice. It was a great deep voice. He talked about some of his interest, which is Civil War history. And also, oddly enough, he mentioned his gun collection. From that phone call, he's like, well, let's go meet right now. And I thought about it. I lived not too far, maybe 5 minutes from the bar that he said, well, let's go hook up at. And of course, I was just going to go there and have Diet Coke. And that's what I did, though. And when he came in, he brought a friend with him. And he was like kind of joking, like, oh, I have to make sure he's here as my safety because I've always seemed to attract the crazy type. He was physically attractive. Something about the way he looked, he was the right height. I'm not very tall, but like if we stood by each other, we looked good together. And he was funny and charming. And the fact that everybody knew who he was because he had been previously in one of the first punk rock bands in the area that we live in. He had several friends that were cops. So he let me know that he had no shortage of power. He was really pretty well known for being funny, charming, good with the women. So that also was like, oh, wow, this guy likes me. Wow, I must be really something then. So from that date, he was like, I'll give you a call. So then he did. I think it was the next day. He offered to fix dinner for me. So I went over to his house and he did that. And he was a single dad and his daughter was there. And I thought, oh, how nice. He's responsible. Perfect gentleman. So I thought things were really going well. And he kept talking about, oh, I love nurses. You're so beautiful. You look exactly like what I'd imagine my girlfriend would be. That first date and then the dinner the next day. And then I found myself either at his house mainly, almost every day. I would go home to get a change of clothes, take care of my dogs, and just come right back. And it was within a week or two that we were talking about me moving in. He was very assuring. He's like, you can move in here. The other thing that played a part is the friend who had accompanied him on the first date. He was like, oh man, he never talks about women. Like he likes you. Just take good care of him. You know, please. He is such a wonderful guy. He likes you so much. And I had no problem believing it because our chemistry was that good. I put my house up for rent and within a month I had moved in with him, sold most of my belongings. I didn't really have a whole lot as far as clothes. I was wearing scrubs as a nurse and not a whole lot of furniture, but I sold the appliances that I had gotten and thought, oh, here, I'm about to live happily ever after. He's like, you can move in here, needs a mother. You know, I have kids of my own, but the girl was just as charming as he was. He was constantly would have a beer in his hand. So within the first 2 weeks, I thought, okay, well, I'll limit it to one or two or three beers a day, which that is just so messed up thinking. That's like the goal of the alcoholic to be able to socially drink. Within a few days, I was finding myself having that beer to three beers. I would get up at 5 a.m. to go take care of my shift for the day. And I had these nursing clogs that were loud and he had hardwood floors. So I didn't even realize it as I was walking up and down the halls. He woke up, came out there in a rage of how dare I disturb him and his daughter has to go to school. And I remember being so shook up. I just went to my patients for that day, like kind of in a state of disbelief, like what the hell just happened? He would then make jokes about it, about how inconsiderate I was. Anything that we would fight about or that he would be angry about would become kind of a running joke of sorts. Within a couple weeks after that, this freak accident happened where a car full of, I think, three teenagers drove right through the bedroom and the car landed like a foot or two where I was in bed and he was in bed as well. One person died. The other person died on impact. It didn't go too well for the other people, the survivors. All of a sudden, you know, where do you go? What do you do? The first thing I did was crack a beer. You know, I can't go to work today. We ended up having to live in a hotel. And at this point, I'm the only bread earner. He never worked. He made it sound like he was independently wealthy. The house was in his name because his mother had passed away and left it. I never asked about finances. And then life in the hotel, I started noticing he would pawn his daughter off on me. He would leave us at the hotel. He would go do whatever he wanted with his friends. Before I knew it, I was the caretaker pretty much of the daughter. As he started getting more and more uncaring, that's when I started to want to drink more and more. And it started affecting my work. I don't think it was more than a month after that work called me in and let me go. Now, I'm sure it was because of hungover performance. So within record time, I'm like fired from my great job, already have given up the house that I had just reestablished. And so at this point, I'm pretty realizing that I'm dependent on him. So I had no money coming in. And at this point now, I'm financially dependent on him. Also, my car got repossessed while I was still there because I wasn't able to make the payments. So now I'm stuck in this house. And he kept saying that we're meant to be together. We're like, you know, Sonny and Cher, we'll never break up. When he'd start to get his way, and if I said anything back and the fight started, he would be like, you can never leave me. You can't. You love me. You're going to stay with me. This isn't bad. I was like, if we could just get back on that good path, I'll get another job because I'm really a good nurse. And the other thing that he would do, he's drinking himself, but if I had a drink, he would go into a tirade of how he doesn't like sloppy women drunks and I'm sloppy. And the abuse got so bad that I would just want to drink and go lay down in a different room, which I did. But he started saying, you've got to get out. Like towards the end of, I think it was like July, he had changed all the way to the point of just 2 weeks straight anger, telling me I had to get out. He couldn't get me to leave. Where was I going to go? He went down to the local city place and said that I had threatened his life. I had threatened his daughter's life. He made up stuff. He got a restraining order. What he did that night was call the ambulance and tell them that I was suicidal. The ambulance came and took me to the hospital. It was more of how he could get me legally out of his house because I was no longer making money at the time. That's why he told 911 or whoever that I had tried to overdose. I had tried to commit suicide. And that was what he did to get me out of the house. So from that point, I went to a woman's shelter for battered women. In the ER, when the doctor saw me, I did have some bruises on me. So, you know, it's funny because he learned not to leave bruises on me after that point, but they were kind enough to let me go to the women's shelter. And that's where they told me about domestic violence because I was like, well, he didn't really hit me and I didn't think I had been abused. But when they told me how, no, locking you out, throwing your purse, putting your belongings on the curb, that's abuse. So from the shelter, I moved in with this friend. It was just a strictly platonic situation. My main concentration was going to AA meetings and getting sober again. At that point, the restraining order was in effect. I did not want to see nor hear of him ever again. So I started going to AA meetings. I had been sober going on a year, and he shows up at the AA meeting. And along the way, I had heard people tell me, they would say, oh, so-and-so asked about you. You know, he says he still loves you. He wants you back. And I'm like, well, he can just go, you know, because that was the most horrible thing I had ever been through in my life. So when he showed up at an AA meeting, I don't know why I didn't want to be not nice at the AA meeting. And I was really impressed because I thought, oh, look, he's going to get sober. And now all those problems, he's going to be able to make as much progress as I have in a year. And maybe we can be friends again. And I went over and spent the day at his house. And he asked me, oh, well, do you want to just move back in? And of course I did. I can't believe I thought, well, let me stay here for a couple weeks because we're going to be sober now. Let's just see how this goes. And so I was back in after a year of being away from him. He framed it like, I was so heartbroken over what I did to you that I've decided I'm going to get sober and try and bring you back. That's the essence of the conversation. And I was so flattered because I had believed that connection so strong. It worked because I'm like, it's not going to hurt to hang out with him. And if we go to meetings together, the first day he doesn't go to a meeting, I'll break up with him. And this type of thing happens quite a lot in recovery where you decide you're going to get sober together. That's the wrong reason to do it. So I just moved in there. I pretty much just go to a meeting every day and work on staying sober and look for a job. I had started to clean houses because I wasn't ready to go back to the stress of nursing. I wanted to get really sure about sobriety before I made any things like that. So to me, I wasn't really moving in. I was going to just hang out at his house and we could go to meetings together and I would see how it goes. And it went really well for like a month or two. We were like the known couple at the recovery meetings, and in public, he would talk very highly of me. I know disagreements came because I was working and he was not, but he expected me to pay for things because I don't pay rent. So before I knew it, that happened that my money was his money. And I did everything. I started going to food banks because we weren't working. So I would be the one to do the footwork to bring food in. He would make me stay in a room for a certain time or give me something to do. And just the silent treatment, and you can't sleep in the bed, you got to go sleep on the floor. Anything I told him, any vulnerability I shared with him would become his weapon the next time. It would be whatever he would control me with or, you know, something to make me feel bad about. I would tell my friends in AA what was going on. And of course, they're like, well, you have to leave him. But I didn't want to do that. That was an answer that I didn't want. So I quit calling people for help. After moving back in with him, I had reestablished myself as a nurse. I got a job at a business college teaching anatomy. So we were going to AA meetings together. I got this job. I really loved it. I taught people anatomy that were going to become medical assistants. And at this point, I do not have a car, but he is letting me use the car his mother had left. I was driving that car to work every day. And during the summer break or the semester break, his daughter was coming to stay for the summer. And my computer was meant for my planning, my classes and things like that. And he told her she could use it whenever she wanted. And I would try and be the gracious person that while she was there, let her use it and just talk to him in private. But it was either his way or the highway. So there came a night, a fight over the computer, that I took the car and I called the cops because I knew how the cops, they're his friends. And I said, I am taking this car to go to my brother's house because this is a fight and I don't want it to escalate. I thought that's all I had to do was give the cops notice. I gave them my name, I gave them the address, and I took that car to my brother's house. And that became the thing. Anytime along this year where we'd have a fight, he would go, "You're going to have to go stay at your brother's. I'm taking you to your brother's. If you don't behave, you're going to go to your brother's." So it became almost a punishment type thing. He started calling my brother to get the car back. He wanted my brother to take it. And he's like, "She isn't going anywhere with your car. When you guys cool down, she'll be back." And apparently that answer wasn't good enough for him. Unbeknownst to me, he went down to the local city and swore out an arrest warrant, said I had stole the car. So this man who was unemployed paid to have that car towed back to his address, leaving me without a car. I'm trying to talk to him or message him. I thought, you know, okay, we'll get over this hurdle and I'll move back in, because it was accepted treatment to me at that point. The semester for that teaching job was about to start, and without transportation, I couldn't go there every day. I had to end up giving that job up. And at that point, I considered, I'm going to be done with him. I got my own car. I started working a local factory that works making tear gas and stuff. So I just got an hourly job there, started going back to meetings again. And then somewhere along the line, I got a job working at a rehab. I worked as the nurse there, handing out the medications for the people in rehabs. I got my first apartment, my first attempt to truly break away, and I was working at the nursing home still. And within a week or two, I started feeling sorry for myself, and so I had some drinks. I called off work at the nursing home a day or two. I let them know that I had to take some time off because the state board was there doing an inspection. They called me to come in, and I just told them the truth that I had drank. I was able to keep that job. And it was during that time I went to the doctor for something else, hip pain. And they did an ultrasound. They wouldn't tell me what it was wrong. And I know when you're a nurse that means the news is bad. They said, "You need to take this film and go to a gynecologist for women." And I'm like, "Oh, crap." It was like 2 weeks before I could get into that gynecologist. So meanwhile, my mind is running. So of course, I started drinking again. The doctor that told me my ovary was the size of a grapefruit, and I figured it was the end. I went on a bender. I told work I couldn't come into work. I called this guy again because I'm like, "Look, I'm probably going to die in a certain number." And I really believed it at that point that I was. And so I went to stay at his house. And he was like, "Oh, yeah, that's horrible news." He bought me more alcohol that night. And during that night, where there was another fight, I forget what it was about, but he locked me out into the cold. I quit talking to this guy. I called my brother to come get me. I ended up staying at his house. I had the surgery. I decided I was two things. I was going to heal from this cancer, and that I was going to get my life in order, and I would never be beholden to anybody ever again. And that's exactly what I was able to do. When I started, I got my own apartment. I put myself first. I started decorating it, you know, the way I wanted to do things. And I had really made the resolve not to talk to him at that point. And that when he knew of my success, that's when like the terrorizing started. People would see him driving by my house. I had blocked him on all kinds of social media. And yet people were letting me know that he was posting things that I was doing. And one day I got home and there was a card from the state police. So I called to see what that was about, and I had them meet me at my brother's, because at this point I didn't want the abuser guy to know where I lived. They came in with like six cop cars and I didn't know what was going on. Well, as it turns out, the guy that I left called the State Board of Nursing and told them that I had stolen drugs. Like, I admitted to the drinking, but here's some more stuff you don't know about, to my last place of employment. And rather than talking to me and asking if it was true, that DON reported the theft or whatever of narcotics to the state board. And they accused me of, like, not keeping proper records on the narcotics. So I ended up in the position of having to go to court to defend myself. And that's eventually what I did. I couldn't afford an attorney to represent me against the state board. But by the time it went to the actual state board where I had to represent myself, I had worked at my current job 2 years. 2 years post-surgery, I had not really missed a day of work or let drinking affect any of my job performance. All my checkups were clean. So after I was able to make the break with him for good, the further I got away from it and living on my own, I would start to remember things. I hit my brakes in the car to stop kind of suddenly. And this pair of sunglasses came tumbling under the bottom of the seat. And I looked down and I remembered they were something I had on when I was in the car with him, that he just went into a rage and he had hit my face with the sunglasses on. And it was crazy because once you move out and you start to really function on your own, these little memories come back of things like that. Just the fear that he would show up and kill me, because he had said so many times, if I can't have you, nobody will. And the year previously, one of the nurses was killed in the parking lot by a vindictive ex. There were times at work where I had to have somebody walk me to the car because I was shaking so bad. But after all the substances stop, when you start to think about your life in terror, it really becomes where you're on edge all the time.
When I spoke with Deborah, I asked her to explain how addiction and rejection contributed to keeping her trapped in a cycle of abuse, and how therapy helped her understand the core issues that alcohol had been masking.
Well, I'm going to have to say, if not 100%, at least 97%. It was an avoidance mechanism to avoid looking at, what am I afraid to face about myself? Why am I not enough? Because relationships and men were the two number one ways I would avoid. You know, you fill that hole in your soul with either the chemical feeling of, hey, I'm okay, or, you know, the warm and fuzzies from a relationship. So you have to do the deep work on yourself and face your fears and learn how to, you know, your own neuroregulation, and learn how to control your fear and how to process your emotions, not just stuff them down by drinking. There came a point before I was able to leave for good that I started to see a therapist, because at least at some point I recognized that I do have this pattern. I want to get away from this guy. I knew I needed to get away from him, and I knew that for some reason I couldn't do it. So that's exactly what I went and saw a therapist about. I said, here's this situation. I need to figure out what about me makes me do this. So, you know, I started working. I would describe patterns in the relationship, and she recommended a couple of books I read. And when I read them, that was the first time I had heard there are people without empathy and that it's way more common. I was like, oh no, this can't be the case. He's just a douche. But then as I started to get more and more educated, I can see that. And I see all of the elements. It was like totally going back over the previous 7 years of my life and seeing it in action. The gaslighting, the convincing me, the triangulation. He always would have another girl that he would be trying to make me jealous with. The constant, just the whole manipulation, the whole never being happy. Those books led me to, once I got out, then the Dirty John podcast. That was also so healing, because here's somebody else that was making decisions like I was, that just even in the face of all this evidence, no, this is going to work. When I joined a Facebook group to talk about that podcast, I was shocked at how much victim shaming was going on. And that was my first exposure or whatever to the fact that people are going to ask you, why didn't you just leave? And that I've been thinking about the answer to that question for a few years now, and I wish I could tell you. It's almost like they have a spell on you, or maybe you could liken it to an addiction. Do yourself better. Realize that there is some type of pull there, but just keep it in mind and get a handle on it. But I understand why you go back. If nothing else, get a supportive crowd like myself of women that were able to do it. I think that part of the victim shaming keeps them going back too, because it becomes hard when you're putting up with that type of attitude. And the closure will come when you finally see you are enough. Nobody else is going to make you more. You are fine as you are. And it's not something that you can just read a self-help book and get there, but you know, there's people that can help you to see it.
And then what lessons has sobriety taught her? And how does she reconcile with the impact that her addiction has had on her family?
That is the one thing that true sobriety and true being in self-love, love of yourself, I learned how to handle any guilt I had over not being the best mom that I could, because, and guilt over that was another thing that would keep me, you know, medicating with alcohol or, you know, whatever the anti-anxiety medications, but alcohol will help you to not have to deal with your guilt. But once I came to terms with that, like, you know, the past is gone. It's this moment right now. And my kids were so gracious about it. They made it known to me that they're just happy to see. They've seen my path. So, you know, luckily they are loving and accepting. And that's one thing that I know that I did right, despite any type of drinking or whatever that I had done, is that my kids grew up and way more well-established than I am, way more functional.
And also, how did she find her way back to healthy romantic relationships?
I decided I would never date anybody again. And that's exactly what happened. I didn't. But my boyfriend from fifth grade started to come around to just visit. So from that point, he just became my friend. And from that friendship point, things evolved. I now know that friendship is where the love is. And it is so funny because I had remembered in fifth grade the feeling like I knew he would be significant to me. There was a point when I realized I like spending time with him more. I mean, I like my alone time too, but not once in any time that I've been with my husband now have I ever thought, oh man, he's getting on my nerves.
And finally, what are some of the passions in her life and what does she care deeply about?
I generally work with women and help them to see that they are enough and that they are beautiful just as they are. And one of the things, having alopecia myself, I opened up a place for women to shop in person for alternative hair because there is such a stigma with wig wearing. It seems to be changing. I've been in business for 5 years now, but the shame of hair loss alone is just, it's quite a thing to deal with. You can do magic with it. When someone's feeling bad about hair loss and they find the right alternative hair, it has ripple effects through their life because now all of a sudden when you are not afraid to look in the mirror and you know you're going to look good, it tends to snowball because then you want to go out and do more things and you're not dreading getting your picture taken. So I have a podcast that kind of demystifies success wearing a wig, some of the things that my viewpoints from somebody that has alopecia and that wears wigs. I help women have the courage to try new styles. I help women in person to look good in a wig and teach them, you know, how to take care of it. It's the Alternative Hair Alchemist. And the reason I titled it Alternative Hair is because when I first went into business, I realized we need to change the way the word wig is held. So I started coining the term alternative hair. And At first, I had to do a lot of explaining of what I meant by alternative hair, which is hair that's suitable to be a replacement on your head, whether it's human, whether it's synthetic, whether it's a topper. It turned out to be a blessing in disguise. That's such a cliche. But the thing is, I realized now, I get ready quicker. I look better than I ever looked in my life.
In the clutches of alcoholism, Deborah discovered herself willing to sacrifice everything, family, friends, career, and health. And while she sought out solace with a partner during a moment of sobriety, together they spiraled deeper into addiction and abuse, trapped in a destructive cycle that felt unbreakable. Finding an enabler only compounded her struggles, with her alcoholism often weaponized against her. Through perseverance, she navigated a difficult journey, overcame others' harsh judgments, and more significantly, her own self-doubt that had haunted her for so long. For Deborah, recovery was within reach, requiring a daily commitment she was prepared to make. It was a lengthy path, but she endured with determination and the backing of those who believed in her. And eventually she found the courage to confront her demons and reclaim the life she knew she deserved. Until next time, I'm Jake Deptula, and this is Love, Lust, Fear. Every guest featured on Love, Lust, Fear selects a charity or organization to share. Please check the show notes on this episode for more details. If you or someone you know is being abused by a partner, there is help available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline provides essential tools and support to help survivors of domestic violence. Just call 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-7233. Or you can text START to 88788. If you'd like to be a guest on Love, Lust, Fear and share your personal dating or relationship story, you can email us at lovelustfearpod@gmail.com or DM us on Instagram at lovelustfearpod. Disclaimer, the information shared on this podcast should not be considered as professional advice or a substitute for seeking professional advice.